last time.
This is my earth, and I live in it. It's one third dirt and two thirds water, and it rotates and revolves through space at rather an impressive pace, and never even messes up my hair. And here's a really weird thing: the force created by its spin is the force that stops the chaos flooding in. This is my earth, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. It's not perfect.
Those of you who are fans will have immediately realised who my guest is on the first time today, just from the opening bars of that song, Not Perfect. He's a comedian, writer, poet, actor, director and musician. His debut solo album, Apart Together, was released 2 years ago in 2020. And while he's known for creating funny songs, and as you can tell from that track, Not Perfect, there's philosophy and politics and satire and self-examination and a lot of heart in nearly all of his work. I'm very pleased to say my guest on the first time this week is Tim Minchin. And I started off by asking Tim, as I do with all my guests, when was the very first time he was aware of music as a child?
The really early stuff is mostly Beatles, is mostly Sgt. Pepper's. I guess I remember... Oh, there's my daughter singing. Hey, daughter singing! I'm on the radio, stop being creative!
Yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
We didn't have a lot of music in the house, as in the folks didn't have the stereo on all the time. But yeah, that album I remember early, and a Simon and Garfunkel live album. But aside from that, we had this pianola in our house, which is my great grandmother's, an inherited 100 plus year old pedal piano and hundreds of rolls. And so a lot of my early memories are about really old school songs being played on that, like Funiculi, Funicula, and, you know, old piano parlor songs, and then all the way through to Elton John songs and Men at Work and stuff, all on the pianola and the family standing around singing. That was the weird thing about my childhood, is this Von Trapp, everyone doing harmonies to the pianola sort of side of things.
Were your folks not particularly musically inclined then?
My mum's brother Jim is a fantastically talented musician, and her other brother, John, played a bit. She can play like five chords on the piano, but it's all by ear. So I guess she gave me a hint very early on that one way to play piano is just, you know, bashing out chords and singing. Mum can sing and Dad can sing. Dad was a boy chorister, as was I, a boy soprano at a grammar school in Perth. But yeah, they were neither musicians nor massive music heads. It wasn't really until my brother got into his teens and he started falling in love with music and getting Australian Rolling Stone every week and pulling out the centerfold poster of whatever band was hot and listening to all those Australian pub rock bands. And it was my brother who dragged me into the music kind of consumption scene.
going back, you mentioned the Beatles and Come Together is one of the songs.
Oh,
that's,
yeah, well, that's a bit later, but yeah.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest band that's ever existed. It's pretty obvious.
Hard to argue with.
What is it about Come Together then? If the seed was planted with Sgt. Pepper?
I don't know, really. I mean, these shows, as I'm sure you understand, I understand why we do them, Desert Island and this, and I mean, I often get asked, what's your favourite band, what's your favourite song, or what's your 10 favourite songs, and it's just unbearable to go through and try and choose songs that are your favourites. It's like, it's the opposite of trying to choose your favourite child, because I know who my favourite child is. It's my dog, Sonny. But you can't, you know. So choosing your favourite Beatles song, or just your favourite jazz standard, or just my favourite Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong duet, or just my favourite, I don't know how to do it. But when I get asked to do these lists or to talk about music, it's always quite fun and illuminating, as long as you don't get yourself tied up. And I chose Come Together this time because I don't know, I don't even know what album it's from. Is it Abbey Road?
It's Abbey Road, yeah.
Ringo's work on Come Together, George's work, just the vibe. Obviously, it's John lyrics, you know, which usually I go for a Paul song because I'm pretty interested in more narrative lyric writing. But, man, the groove, Paul's bass playing on that. And I guess also because I played it 100 times in pubs and at weddings. But even the riff, you know, it's just a cracker. And, you know, it's one of those songs with such obscure lyrics that you feel quite proud when you've learnt them all.
Ringo being the most Ringo, George being the most George, Paul being the most Paul, and John being the most John, all on one song. It's the best of all of them.
Yeah, and the thing that just shocks me always with the Beatles, and I said this to Paul when I got to interview him, is the sophistication for their age. It's very easy to forget that all these songs were written in their 20s. How old were they when they wrote Abbey Road? I mean, not 30.
28, something like that.
Yeah, so incredible musical sophistication, but lyrical sophistication too, even when they were so-called missteps, even when it's a bit daggy or a bit wannabe Hindi or, you know, or whatever, you know, across the universe, even when it feels a bit contrived, it's incredible. And then to think that these songs didn't ever get played live is just so mind-blowing, that we, the inheritors of this work, we played it live, we massacred it, all these songs. They never did it. Did they play Come Together on the Roof? They might have played it on the roof.
No, they didn't. No, they didn't do it.
So it's never been played by those boys live. In fact, they might have never played it again after that day. I mean, I'm sure there are Beatles nerds out there going, no, you don't know anything. It happened here and here and here and here. So I don't know. But sometimes I think a lot about how these songs that feel so embedded never got workshopped live. They were just experiments.
What was the first single that you owned? Can you remember?
I want to say that it was Thriller by Michael Jackson.
But
the truth is, I don't know if I bought it as a single, but I think the first time I ever went to a shop and used my own money to buy an album was to buy Bananarama's third album, which had the cover of Venus.
Venus was a
I like that cover.
Because it was a crowd. I have no idea. I guess I was in year 86 or 87. So I was in year 6 or 7. And one thing about my music taste is I've never been one of the cool kids. And I've never... Later I did. At 15, 16, 17, I let my friends drag me. But I remember like getting bullied a bit in year 9 because... Someone asked me what music I liked, and I said the Black Sorrows. And you probably wouldn't know the Black Sorrows, but amazing sort of country rock Australian band that my uncles actually played with. And kind of in that Paul Kelly mode, run by a guy called Joe Camilleri, and the Bull sisters, Vicar and Linda Bull, who went on to have amazing careers, were the sort of backing vocalists in that band. Anyway, and I just got hassled so much because I didn't know that there was music you were meant to like.
yeah.
So the fact that I went out at the age of 11 or 12 and bought Bananarama is a source of great pride for me, and probably doesn't surprise listeners who know my work, because there's nothing cool about anything I've ever done, really. It's all pretty nerdy.
But I like that when we do this show, someone says their first record was like Kraftwerk, and you're like, it wasn't, it was the Wombles,
yeah,
just be honest.
Totally,
please. What about the first album that you bought then? Because that's a different thing, especially when you're young, because you immerse yourself in the sleeve and you immerse yourself in the kind of story from the start to the finish, and you have that kind of deeper relationship with it maybe than
I don't know the big record answer to these questions, and the truth is, I was not bothered. I wasn't interested in music or bands.
Okay.
Ever. Still not, really. All I've ever been interested in is going, oh, could I play that? And so my entire history with music from my earliest memories, well, my earliest memories are I wasn't bothered, except like standing listening to She's Leaving Home from Sgt. Pepper's. I remember getting a bit obsessed by that song really young.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock as the day begins. Silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key, stepping outside, she is free.
We gave her most of our lives,
is leaving,
sacrificed most of our lives. We gave her everything money could buy.
Snores as his wife gets into a dressing gown, picks up the letter that's lying there, standing alone at the top of the stairs. She breaks down and cries to her husband, Daddy, our baby's gone. Why would she treat us so thoughtlessly? How could she do this to me?
We never thought of ourselves.
That's a conversation to have later, maybe, when we're talking about what I like in songwriting. But I've never been interested in pop culture or pop music culture. I reckon by the time I was an adult, I'd probably watched 20 music videos in my life.
Really?
That's yeah, because we didn't really watch telly. We weren't allowed to watch telly. And we played a lot of sport. And if we were watching telly, it was like the cricket was on or something. But we weren't really a telly-watching family. So I don't know what my first album was. But I can tell you what records I liked in my parents' collection, and actually one really quite early one was the Big Chill soundtrack, which actually, if you think about that album, I actually can be very proud of the fact that was something I liked, because that's an amazing record. I think it's got I Got Sunshine
on a Cloudy Day. When it's cold out,
I think it's got Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Yeah.
It's got Whiter Shade of Pale. Good Lovin'.
Lovin'.
It's got Jeremiah was a bullfrog. That's a good friend of mine. I mean, it's a massive album. Give Me Some Lovin'. I mean, it was like an amazing soundtrack album. I don't know if I bought it. I reckon my godfather gave it to me, actually, now I'm thinking about it, on vinyl, after tapes came in, but I got it on vinyl. So let's give me a little bit of cool kudos and say Big Chill. You know you're in trouble when having the Big Chill album is your version of cool.
That's what makes it cool. 70s of Rye by Queen is on the list. Is that as obvious as just hearing that opening piano and wanting to play that like he played it?
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, it's just a cracking. I mean, Brian's stuff in that is amazing. And I loved Queen so much. The big orchestral, the camper, the better, and obviously the Rhapsody. I've always thought Seven Seas of Rye an incredible, just the pace of it, the kind of driving guitar and that opening riff and Freddie's voice and, yeah, Roger just going off. I mean, it's monstrous, monstrous, monstrous. And the production on those records, just amazing.
Yeah. Not just in the lyrics, but the whole presentation, the whole dynamic of that music. I guess, was that something that pressed a button in this emerging idea of, like, stage theatre?
I don't know.
They're definitely allied together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I come from a theatre background. Mm. I mean, I was doing plays and school musicals and writing music for theatre before I was trying to sell, you know, records, trying to be a singer-songwriter, which is long before I even thought about comedy, and comedy was literally something I did for 6 years, and since then I've gone back to theatre. And so, yeah, my comedy show, in inverted commas, is just a cabaret show gone wrong, and it comes with all that shameless camp, you know. I had no idea what I was walking into when I came to the UK in 2005. I had no idea that everyone was doing alternative comedy and wearing t-shirts and shuffling around. And, you know, I thought, I didn't know that you weren't meant to have lighting cues in your comedy show. I just didn't know. I wasn't necessarily trying to channel anyone. I just thought, how do you make people watch you when you got a head like this? You know, better put some makeup on and get some lighting cues.
Mm. Another first. Can you remember the first performance of Dark Side? So that's 2005. Can you remember thinking that it was really working?
Oh, yeah. My sense that it was working was probably... Actually, my first ever show was called Naval Cerebral Melodies with Umbilical Cords.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little band. It was at a club called the Kitten Club where I used to play. And it was a cabaret show and it had weird monologues and poems. And it was just me trying to find an audience by just kitchen sinking it, you know, like, what am I good at? Well, I'm not great at anything, but I can play piano and I can sing a bit and I can write and I'm articulate and I can have a rant and I can write a beat poem. And I started doing all this stuff and I'm a bit of an actor, so I can do sort of character stuff. And then that first couple of nights, and again, I had Sarah, my wife, sitting on a 6-channel lighting desk pulling blackouts and spots, and I'm like, no, every song has 8 cues, like completely obsessive. I'd never done 10 minutes comedy or anything. This was a 2-act, hour and a half long show straight out of the gate because I come from a theatrical background. It's like you put on a play, you don't muck around, and people just laughed the whole time and then shut up when I was being more somber, and I just had them on a string. And that was the beginning. That was late 2003. And then 2004, I just hacked away at it and hacked away at it. And then 2005, I appeared in Edinburgh seemingly fully formed, but it had taken a long time. And I'd only just straightened my hair and put on the eye makeup just before Christmas in 2004. That look was only 3 months old when I did the Melbourne Comedy Festival and about 8 months old when I got to Edinburgh.
Time a lot of the Ben Folds comparisons in the approach to the piano and the lyricism, and one of the songs that we've talked about is Stephen's Last Night in Town, which is a great song off their second record. Tell me a bit about first kind of meeting, I guess falling in love with Ben and how that relationship worked, and then personally kind of getting to know him.
Well, somewhere in the 90s, after their first record, just went on Whatever and Ever Amen, their second record, I believe, I got that album, and I think it was, in my memory, it's in a similar year, the same year or the year after or before, an album by the Whitlams, which is an Australian band led by a guy called Tim Friedman, and that album was called Eternal Nightcap. And it was this period where I'd been writing songs and playing in bands with my brother since we were kids, you know. Like everyone, started out playing Doors covers and Deep Purple covers and In Excess and Hoodoo Gurus and Crowded House and, you know, lots of Oz rock and Down Under rock. And then started writing our own songs and blah, blah. And I'd been doing that for years and trying to work out if... Because this is grunge era, remember. This is I was bathed at that stage in Pixies and, you know, Pearl Jam and Nirvana and all that stuff. And I was trying to work out if, I guess I thought, well, I'll never be proper because I play piano, and piano, you know, is a bygone instrument. And actually that, of course, was the main joke of my original Edinburgh show. I'm too piano-based and middle-class to have a career. That's the joke of the song Rock and Roll Nerd. But Ben and the Whitlams hit, and I went, oh, my God, you're allowed. And what suited me about Ben, much more so than Tim Friedman, was that he bashed the crap out of the thing. And, you know, my streamed album concert, he's a guest on that, and it's a terrible idea to have Ben Folds as a guest. He just makes me look like I have no hands, you know. Anyway, I listened to it a lot, and I was playing piano bars around that era, and I'd play Brick and One Angry Dwarf on the piano at the piano bar. And so that kind of, he kind of gave me permission to keep writing. And you can hear his influence in Rock and Roll Nerd, which I wrote, by the way, before he wrote Rock in the Suburbs. I then, years later, and I can't remember why, got in touch with him, and I don't know, I went to a show and I met him, and somehow he became aware of what I was doing. And then, of course, Matilda came along, and he's been interested in writing musicals, but that's not as easy as it seems, and wanted to ask me about that, and we sort of became friends. And then a couple of years ago, after I moved back to Australia, I got up on stage at the Sydney Opera House and played One Angry Dwarf while he played drums. And
is he a really good drummer as well?
Yeah, he's an amazing drummer. Amazing bass player. Incredibly musical, like way, way beyond me. That's a proper meeting your heroes thing.
Ben Folds 5 with the brilliant Stevens' Last Night in Town from their second record, 1997's Whatever and Ever Amen. This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Tim Minchin. And we'll talk about meeting your heroes and why it took so long for Tim to record and release an album, and his audience philosophy right after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Frances Reid. Fans are arriving at Wembley, where England's women's footballers are hoping to make history later when they take on Germany in the final of the European Championship. A win would secure the first major trophy for the Lionesses. Prince William and Princess Charlotte have wished them well in a video posted on Twitter, and the England men's captain, Harry Kane, also had a message for the team.
Hi, Lionesses. Just wanted to wish you all the best for today's game against Germany. Going to be an incredible experience, incredible atmosphere at Wembley. Can't wait to be there myself, so wishing you all the best. Good luck, go get that win. The whole country's behind you, we're behind you, really looking forward to it, so all the best.
The office of the Prince of Wales has insisted that all rules were followed when the Prince of Wales's charitable fund accepted a donation from the family of Osama bin Laden. The Sunday Times has reported that Prince Charles received a £1 million payment from his half-brothers, Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, in 2013. Clarence Howe says the decision to accept the money came from the charity's trustees, and the Prince's charity fund has told the BBC that the Foreign Office cleared the donation. In Ukraine, the southern city of Mykolaiv came under sustained attack from Russian missiles overnight. The city's mayor said it was probably the heaviest bombardment since the start of the invasion in February. Among the casualties were one of Ukraine's richest men and his wife. From Mykolaiv, Andrew Harding reports.
The explosions began soon after midnight and continued well beyond dawn. Rockets and missiles damaged two schools, a hotel, and many other buildings, triggering fires and leaving giant craters in residential neighbourhoods. One of Ukraine's richest men, a grain exporter, was killed with his wife at their riverside mansion. Mykolaiv is a key strategic city, currently blocking Russia's advance west along the Black Sea coast.
The Ministry of Defence says 460 migrants in 12 boats crossed the Channel yesterday, which is one of the highest figures for a single day this year. More than 1,000 people have made the dangerous journey in the past week. President Biden says he's feeling fine after testing positive for COVID-19 for a second time within 10 days. He tested negative four times last week. His doctor described it as a rebound infection and said there was no need for treatment. Dr. Peter Hotez is from the Center for Vaccine Development in Texas.
Anecdotally, it appears to be a lot more common than we were led to understand from the clinical trials, and it may be because of these unique Omicron subvariants, which replicate in far higher viral loads.
As parts of the UK have been facing wildfires, there have been mounting concerns about the danger that disposable barbecues can pose. The campaign group Keep Britain Tidy and the London Fire Brigade are calling for an immediate ban. England have secured another gold medal at the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. Jake Jarman came out on top in the men's gymnastics all-around final. His teammate James Hall won silver. That's Six Music News. The next update's at 2:30.
BBC Radio.
Six Music.
He doesn't have a problem with drugs. He just doesn't get them. He's fine that his mates have tattoos, but he thinks they'll regret them. He likes going to pubs, but he hates it when the music's too loud. He tends not to go to rock concerts, 'cause he can't stand the crowds. But all he's ever wanted to be is a rock star on MTV. But he knows that it's not unlikely. He just turned 30. He knows that he will always be a rock and roll nerd. He'll keep writing songs the world will never hear. And though they won't be heard, he'll just keep writing. Oh yeah.
That was Tim Minchin with the track Rock and Roll Nerd, a song contrasting the lifestyle between the stereotypical rock star's life and his own supposedly rather more mundane one. This is the first time I'm Matt Everett, and my guest today is the aforementioned rock and roll nerd, Tim Minchin. Now, we were talking before the news about meeting your heroes, and as this show is about first times, I asked him about how he behaved when he met some of his heroes for the first time, and if he ever lost it with them.
No, that's the thing about heroes is, again, because I'm not that interested in pop culture, as in I'm not interested in the story behind the music. I never stood at a stage door or collected all the records or ever thought to pursue anyone. I've never gone, I hope I meet that person. I mean, the biggest ones for me are the writers. I've had dinner with Tom Stoppard a couple of times and drunk with Stephen Sondheim. And
wow.
Definitely had shots with Ian McKellen and Dame Judi Dench and Benedict Cumberbatch and David Tennant and all those guys, and I've become really good friends with the author Neil Gaiman, and Buffy legend Joss Whedon was a massive one for me. I once had dinner with Ian McEwan and Zadie Smith. That's probably the peak, you know, and I say that at the risk of sounding like a complete sort of snob. I've also met Tom Cruise and Sandra Bullock and, I don't know, Matthew Broderick. And, I'm just thinking of parties, you know. And some of them I met for a little bit and some of them I sat down with, but it doesn't get better than Ian McEwan and Zadie Smith. I mean, and Stoppard, having dinner with Stoppards and finding them to be joyous. What you learn is that people are people, obviously. It absolutely doesn't matter how big and famous they are. They're just people. You learn that very quickly. And once you've learned that, everything resets and all you're doing is the same as when you meet anyone. You're just waiting to see who they are.
In terms of lyrics, the lyrics that chime for you, you mentioned She's Leaving Home and I was listening to, you mentioned the Whitlams as well. I was listening to No Aphrodisiac and there's the line, tired teacher, 28, 6, regular meetings for masculine, muscular, nappy-clad, brutal breeding. And I thought that's a very Tim Minchin approach to a line in a really good way. What do you look for in a lyric?
What I love in other people's lyrics is not necessarily what I see as my strengths, although there's a Venn diagram there. There's plenty of crossover in what I aim for. But I guess I look for and aim for universal truths devoid of cliches. That's tough, right? Because people have been writing poems for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Shakespeare did it all. Shakespeare said all the universal truths devoid of cliches. With such success that they became the cliches. But actually, all these years later, they're so good that they're almost cliche-proof, or at least they never sound like fridge magnets. but I talk about fridge magnetism. I try to avoid fridge magnetism, but almost create... You want to create iconic phrases that make people go, oh, that's exactly how it is, but I've never thought of it like that before. And I guess I'm attracted to that in other people. I'm also attracted to lyrics that I couldn't write, of course. I can write quite beautiful lyrics and quite evocative lyrics, but it's usually quite sort of literary and quite didactic and quite, you know, I'm explaining everything as I go. I sort of demand of you a particular interpretation. People who write lyrics that are much more Jackson Pollock, you know, I'm creating patterns and shapes with these words and you can read into them whatever you want. I admire that hugely. I feel like I can't do that for some reason.
I wanted to ask you about Jesus Christ Superstar because
yes.
The film loomed large in my childhood because I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Because
I still don't know what's going on with that film.
I kind of knew the Jesus story, but I didn't understand the film, which is kind of barrier breaking in many ways, the way it kind of, it's a play but it's not, and the characters are real but they're not, and they're playing a role. Pretty and to play Judas in that, it's a lot stranger than I think it gets credit for. That must have been a joy playing that role, getting to do that bit.
Yeah, so we, you know, if we're talking about my history with albums, I don't know when JC Superstar came along, but I suspect it was there all along.
Every time I look at you, I don't.
Don't get me wrong.
Don't get me wrong.
Don't get me wrong.
Don't get me wrong.
I wanna know.
I wanna know.
concept album, the original Murray Head and Ian Gillan. The movie was not on my radar at all. I didn't see it till years later. And, okay. and after I was obsessed by it, I think I didn't see it till I first did Jesus Christ Superstar. I've done it three times, once at the Quarry Amphitheatre in Perth, and I understudied Judas, once at His Majesty's Theatre in Perth, and I understudied Judas, both amateur productions, and once at the O2 Arena. I don't know, but I used to sing that record through, standing in our family room with that vinyl on Mum and Dad's record player when everyone went out, and there's a lot of us, so I had to pick my moments. I would just put it on and start singing and try and sing the whole thing and make myself cry singing Gethsemane and, you know, through my teens, which is why somehow, even though I do not have the vocal chops really, I can do it through an act of will, you know. My ability to sing Judas is a sort of miraculous act of stubbornness, which is a pretty good way to describe my entire career, as sort of stubbornness. By the time I turned up to rehearsals for that show, I just was absolutely sure I could do it, that I could make people feel what I thought that character needed to make people feel. And I have seen a lot of versions where it fails. So I wasn't only, I think I can do it, but I had all this other hubris about, I know what this story needs. I know how this should be sung. I know what words to land on because I understand this text. And I'm not going to back away from that. I think I did understand the text by then because I had written musicals by then and I had written a lot of music for theatre by then and I had done the show three times and I'm a lyricist and I'd met Andrew I think and Tim and I think I back my beliefs, you know.
Yeah,
it's absolutely amazing piece of theatre. Those boys were in their early 20s. Andrew wasn't 20. And it is a couple of teenagers virtually going, hold on, Judas was a victim of God's will. Let's write a musical from Judas's point of view. Yeah. Can you imagine the balls or whatever bits now represent bravery?
It's interesting when artists, when musicians, when bands have got like the song, or some bands have got a couple of songs, a couple of those kind of tunes that it's almost, if I can say this in a way that doesn't sound awful, it's like the audience are holding them to ransom every night. It's like you have to do dot 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 that big single, or you have to do dot 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 that ballad because that's the contract that we've entered into when we've come to the gig. And you've got a couple of those, you've got Not Perfect. It's quite a rarefied club to have those songs. And I wonder what your relationship is like with White Wine and those things that you have.
I really like Christmas. It's sentimental, I know, but I just really like it. I'm hardly religious. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer. But I still really like it. Looking forward to Christmas, though I'm not expecting a visit from Jesus. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. Don't go in for ancient wisdom. I don't believe just 'cause ideas are tenacious, it means that they're worthy. get freaked out by churches. Some of the hymns that they sing have nice chords, but the lyrics are dodgy. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to the miseducation of children who in tax-exempt institutions are taught to externalize blame and to feel ashamed and to judge things as plain right or wrong. But I quite like the songs. I'm not expecting big presents. The old combination of socks, jocks and chocolates is just fine by me, 'cause I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad.
I remember watching Kings of Leon once. I've only been to about 10 gigs in my life in stadiums, but I went and saw Kings of Leon because they were somewhere where I was touring, and I remember them playing Sex on Fire, and I've never seen people look so depressed. you know, it depends on what sector of my fan base you're kind of tapping into. I guess everyone wants me to play Prejudice, which I don't mind playing it, but it's way down my list. You know, it would go in the bin straight away if it was just about me, but it's not just about me. My job is to entertain. But I've got, you know, Not Perfect and White Mind the Sun and Rock and Roll Nerd and Dark Side, and I've got enough songs. But you may have noticed I'm not an audience chaser. I have maybe things that seem like opposing philosophies. One is, I think when people have bought tickets at increasingly not unreasonable prices, you know, like people spend good money to go and see me nowadays because I don't tour very much and there's demand, so the ticket prices go up and I cap them and stuff, but it's a lot of money. And I feel a huge weight of responsibility to make sure everyone walks out thinking it was worth it. And when you look out there at all these people and you know a lot of them have saved up or gone without, I really feel that. So I absolutely go out on stage every night and design my shows to be, I want people going, oh my God, that was the best, you know. That said, I think trying to second guess what the audience wants is a fool's game. What you have to give them is what you think is a wicked night, depending on where you are in your career.
Don't wanna be in your club if you take me as a member. I'm not even slightly interested in whether I'm remembered. I say ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Give me a tombstone if you feel you must. Say, here lies a clown who wrote some songs. He taught too much and stayed too long. Back home in Perth, I play piano down at Cafe Piazza. Swallowing secondhand smoke and singing standards by the masters. Learned that every lyric's sacred, that love's everything, and that three drinks makes you straighten up and forget you're swinging. Till my crowd scared the suits away and I play my own songs. And then we talk too much and stay too long.
Talk too much, stay too long.
Moved to Melbourne with my missus after locking her down. Felt like a very little fishy in a very big town. Barely scraping by on corporate gigs and quaint cabaret. Playing keyboards in a cover band until 3 in the a.m. I was never really suited to them top 40 songs, 'cause I talked too much and played too long. Don't wanna be in your club if you take me as a member. I'm not even slightly interested in whether on that opening night. But to my surprise, there was a rising
too much and stay too long. I played the Albert Hall and Wembley, I played basements and bars. I've been to Hollywood and Broadway, met those A-lister stars. I've shared cigarettes with knights and shot tequila with dames. Found I'm more interested in laughter than in hotness and fame. So long as you got irony, honey, we'll get along. We can talk too much and stay way, way too long.
That's Talk Too Much, Stay Too Long from Tim's 2020 album Apart Together. So you've been making music your whole life, but why does it take so long to record a debut album?
I was heading towards this. I made an album in 2000 with my band called Timmy the Dog, my brother, and we made an album in our house that was like a glorified demo. 15 tracks, though, was, you know, and string quartets and horns and everything. I've always been obsessed
really?
By. Yeah, yeah, crazy, crazy, crazy. 15 tracks in 3 days. I then went and tried to get a record deal and didn't, and tried to get an acting agent and didn't, and moved to Melbourne and was playing in cover bands and all that stuff I talked about earlier. And the cabaret stuff just took off, and I became a comedian, and then I wrote Matilda, and then I wrote Groundhog Day, and then I went to LA, and then I started acting, and I just kept all along going, I suppose I should make a record. I mean, that was what I was doing. But I released live albums and live DVDs, and it just got kicked down the road because it's always the thing that can wait, isn't it? When someone's saying, come and direct this movie, or come and be in a crazy blockbuster Robin Hood remake, or come and do Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at the STC, or come and play Judas. I'm not going to go, no, I'm doing my album that 6 months, my album that no one asked for, you know. But it's just time flies, Matt.
What's the last song that we should play then, Tim?
Well, the last song is Get Lucky, and, I mean, it's a cracking track. Pharrell is preternaturally gifted producer and songwriter, I think. I don't listen to music very much. I haven't stayed in touch particularly well. But I did happened to have a Grammy nomination in 2014, which is another whole story, for the Broadway Matilda cast album. So I had to go to these horrendous, endless awards, self-congratulatory Americans. And I actually was hugely honoured to be nominated, but the awards were miserable. Sort of, you weren't allowed to drink, and you were sort of shuffled through like sheep, and people shouting at you and treating you like crap. And I'm just like, I'm sitting here with three little girls in beautiful dresses. The three Matildas came, and I was just so angry at how sort of... Anyway,
that's a shame. That's such a shame.
Kinky Boots, the musical, won the Grammy that year. So, you know, you be the judge. So partly it was just sort of knowing that we wouldn't win anything because we weren't really in the scene, and, you know, bitterness and being a bad loser and stuff. But so we had this ridiculous thing where I was sitting for 5 hours in a theater with three girls and then sort of being shunted around. But we did get to go to the main concert, the main awards.
Yeah.
And there was no food and no drinks and no one. I sort of sat down just going, why are we here? And then Beyonce and Jay-Z got up and did Might Have Been Drunk in Love. And then Pharrell got up with Daft Punk and Stevie Wonder and Nile Rodgers and did this sort of Get Lucky mashup. And it just was a beautiful note to me, like, shut up, Minch. You know, you come from Perth, listen to this music, listen to these people, look at Stevie, listen to Stevie's voice. He's been playing for 65 years. Listen to the passion and the focus, and listen to the lyrics. And, you know, who cares if you've sat in the theatre for 8 hours and got fed corn chips and had to deal with three very sad little girls? And it just healed me, you know. And I'm not you know, I don't listen to music like some people do. I find music quite stressful, to be honest, a lot of the time. I find it hard to figure out what I want to listen to. Often turn on Spotify and then switch it off. I can't find something that doesn't make me anxious or get up in my neurons, you know. But every now and then you have an experience and you can't tell where it's going to be and you can't tell what genre it's going to be, where music does its job on you, which is to completely remind you that this is beyond earthly, you know. It's transformative and transporting, and it can just be a funk tune by Pharrell. That was a good moment. Sometimes you gotta, music's gotta slap you in the face a bit.
I was watching it last night. I hadn't seen it for ages, and it is just, it's joy. Like, the band, they've got Omar Hakim, who's like the best on drums, and he was like
monstrous,
incredibly good. And you can see that there's a moment, because it starts off good, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's happening. That thing's happening that you talk about. That thing's happening.
When Stevie goes to the keyboard.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Stevie looks, it's like, oh, he doesn't know the song. But you realise that probably looking back, maybe the sound coming in his ears wasn't right, or, you know, like something was tense. And then Daft Punk drop, you know, the screen goes up and there they are. And then it just, the beat's like there. And then it kicks. And then they're all just like in joyland and the audience is on its feet. And, you know, it's pretty great. And music feels like that to play a lot of the time. And sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it feels awful. And when it does, it feels perfect.
Then that's the song we'll end on. It's been very good to speak to you, man. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Like the legend of the phoenix, all ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.
That is Get Lucky by Daft Punk, the final choice on my guest on the first time this week, Tim Minchin. Tim's debut album, as we talked about, Apart Together, is out now. The second series of his Sky Atlantic comedy, Upright, will be along soon. And the award-winning musical, Matilda, is still running in the West End. And as if all that wasn't enough, Matilda the film, directed by Danny DeVito and featuring Tim's brilliant songs, will be in cinemas this December. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you go to the BBC Sounds app, you can hear previous first-time shows from this series, including my chats with Joan Armour Trading, Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand, Shun Kuti, and the legendary Herbie Hancock. Thanks for listening. She's up all night to the sun. I'm up all night to get some. She's